Cat in the Hat, Fox in Socks, or Horton.
Oh no.
I have the power, and it feels so good.
Oh my goodness. I don't know. I don't like Cat in the Hat. He makes me uncomfortable.
It doesn't help that the Jim Carrey monstrosity happens.
Oh, I never bothered seeing it.
And I didn't either.
It was awful. Like, we're talking, oh god, we're Michael Bay bad. Like, I'll go that far and put that. Yeah.
Was there lens flare?
No.
Did the Cat in the Hat explode something and walk away from it without looking at it?
Things did blow up, and I don't remember if he walked away from it, but yeah, that movie was a dumpster fire. Like, everything about it was a dumpster fire. So that really kind of tempers my...
But I feel like that's the Cat in the Hat's whole shtick. Like, here's some order. I'm going to make it a dumpster fire solely because I think it's fun. He's he's the Joker of children's literature.
I was, as you started talking, I was literally about to say that.
Oh, gosh.
Like, I remember even as a child being like, this is deeply unnerving. I'm going to steer clear of this narrative.
See, prior to the movie coming out, though, I actually really liked The Cat in the Hat.
Because of course you did.
Yeah, well, I mean, The Cat in the Hat's probably an 8. So that's, to circle back around to something we'll come back to in a few minutes, an Enneagram 8, I would wager. Kyle, what do you think? Would you wager The Cat in the Hat is an 8? Because he kind of marches to his own beat.
No, I think he's a 7.
7?
Because I think he's like, well, let's just have fun. Who cares about responsibility?
That's fair. Yeah. Probably a 7.
I'm kind of thinking 7. Ugh. Maybe a 7 wing 8. That would make sense.
I could
sense.
See a 7 wing
7
8.
7 wing 8. Okay.
Blech. Gross.
Okay, so Fox and Socks.
And then Horton. I would say Horton because he's all about like respecting people.
Can I be honest? I've never read Fox and Socks.
I don't think I have either.
What?
No. I was like, yeah, I know what socks are about. Foxes don't wear them. This is nonsense.
So I'm going to harken back a couple episodes now because a lot of things are coming together for me. Because you see, so we had that whole conversation a little while back about the fact that I hadn't figured out my Hogwarts house in Pottermore, right?
Okay.
So I went back and I did it after you guys greatly harassed me. And I found out that I am a Hufflepuff, I have to admit. And at first I was really disappointed. And then I started looking up or just like bothering to click on all of the Facebook, like 15 Instagram posts about Hogwarts houses and things like that, right?
Yes, and I start reading. Dial down the Hogwarts internet hole.
And the more I read it, the more I go, oh, I am a Hufflepuff. Oh, this makes so much sense now.
It's okay, though. You get a musical now. It's called Puffs. It's very popular, I hear.
Good to know.
The youths tell me it's the rage.
Not that you would ever see it, though.
No, of course not. It's Hufflepuff.
As a devout Ravenclaw.
No, actually, Alan's a Ravenclaw.
I am the Ravenclaw.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I mixed that up.
Get your houses straight, Kyle.
It's
okay.
I know.
It's okay.
I'm such a confused
person. We don't socially act like our houses all too much.
No.
Yeah.
It's only in our work, really, that our houses really come out.
Yeah.
I think it's more. I'm going to go with Horton as well.
Yeah.
Because even in my younger days, the... Wait a second. What am I thinking? Horton. Good grief. Give me the 30-second Horton breakdown. I am completely
Elephant,
brain farting.
He hears a who.
Yeah,
carries
you know,
a flower
a
around.
Person's a person no matter how small. Yep.
Yes. Yes. I always liked Horton better. I think that is the easiest way I can put that, because I started to go down the taking care of the earth, whatchamacallem, but that is...
Oh, you mean the Lorax?
I started to associate Horton with the Lorax, and I was like,
not the same thing. Because I did not have a nightmare about Horton when I was 5. I had a nightmare about the Lorax when I was 5. Because I went through that period of public school education where they made us watch the Lorax every Earth Day.
Yep.
Every single Earth Day, that same VHS. And for whatever reason, I started to develop this recurring nightmare where the Lorax, or whatever the thing is. Is it called the Lorax? The thing with the mustache that's like, hey.
I think it.
Yeah, he says, I'm the Lorax.
Yeah, okay. I couldn't remember because it's warped in my mind now because of this nightmare.
I always just think of his mustache because his mustache talks. You don't see his mouth. It's just his mustache moving.
Well, and I think that's what freaked me out about it is that you couldn't see all of his face because my nightmare was that I would wake up in a Dr. Seuss house, except it was circular and covered in windows. And no matter what window I looked out of, the Lorax was in it, grinning at me with like massive, massive teeth. And no matter where I looked, there he was. And I didn't do anything. But then I was like afraid to use napkins and paper towels for months.
So what that actually was future Kyle Druid going back in time and sticking little Loraxes outside so you actually think about conservation and things. So he was sub-implanting memories into your childhood using the Lorax to promote his Druid agenda.
Not cool, future Kyle. Not cool.
Alan, why do you have to go and give away my secrets like that?
Because I'm an Enneagram 8. Yeah. Hi, everybody. This is the MinMax Podcast. This is episode 51, and Kyle is at the helm with the this, this, or that, so I'm going to pitch it back to you, because you have not yet given us your answer.
I was trying to get there with the whole Hufflepuff thing, because my answer was Fox and Socks.
Really?
Yes, because it's just silly and absurd and fun, and things rhyme, so...
Like most of the books.
All right, Fox and Socks.
I don't understand where you're coming from.
I approve. I will also say, it is weird being on this end of... it is weird being on the receiving end of the this, this, or that question. I'm not sure how I feel about it yet. We're going to have to do this a few more times before I think I'll ever get used to it.
Yeah, you don't do well when you're not in control.
Nope. Nope.
It makes you really uncomfortable.
Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah, it does. But I will live. So, we've got a couple bits of feedback. That we are going to be getting into. Why are you laughing?
I'm just laughing because you're just like, nope, I'm uncomfortable. And then you just bypass that real quick. Like, we're not going to talk about it.
Oh, goodness. This is all sorts of fun. We're not going to talk about that. No, I don't care. We can totally do an entire episode on not being in control. That would be all sorts of uncomfortable, but very, very fun at the same time. Because then you guys get to know the freaky stuff that happens inside of my brain all the time.
No, I'd rather not delve deep dive.
Oh, you should. It's fun.
No, I get that every day. That's what I'm saying. Let's spare myself.
Spare into the depths of my soul.
I think the rest of us will just stay safely away and
so we've
continue
got a little bit
to
feedback,
affirm Ashley
a little bit of housekeeping stuff that we want to address, and then we're going to go ahead and jump into our topic for the day. Wanted to immediately address an email that we received but had not yet gotten the chance to respond to. So we got an email a little while ago from Jeff Jackson, and he finally sent us over his character sheet for Wendell and Dowie. And we just want to say, Jeff, it sounds delightful. The build looks really fun. And I just want to see a picture of Dowie because that would make me very, very happy. Hedgehog companion, come on. That's just all sorts of fun.
Beyond precious.
It is very, very precious.
I may or may not have started looking up hedgehogs in our area and being like, do these travel?
Yeah, if only we could. We also got ourselves another voicemail, which you will hear in 3, 2, 1.
Hi, MinMax Podcast. This is Brady calling in from the beautiful Rocky Mountains, and feel free to share this on the waves on air. And I wanted to talk to you about a definition you need to provide anime and video games. Let's take it from the bottom and go to the top. So I really enjoyed your episode about difficulty and whether or not we're owed to be able to beat the game simply because we purchased it. Though I'm disappointed in you. You clearly haven't watched Game Maker's Toolkit. It's a YouTube channel put together by Mark Brown, and he produces some pretty cool stuff. He recently released an episode about less assist mode and how that affects difficulty and play accessibility. As for anime, well, when you talked with the Gilmore Ball Z folks, it reminded me that I wanted to contribute to your earlier discussion, specifically about how anime tends to portray Christians, especially Christian leaders, in a less than positive light. After thinking about it for a bit when you first said that, I realized I could only think of one Christian leader that was portrayed positively. Nicholas D. Wolfwood of Trigun. And I think part of the reason why he's allowed to be portrayed positively is because he wears his imperfections on his sleeve and doesn't pretend to be perfect. Make of that as you will. And as for definitions, a while back you mentioned ideograms, but you never defined them, and I can't spell to save my life. Please, explain this to me. Now, I guess I'll just use the remainder of my time to rave about how great the current season of My Hero is. And oh man, did you see when Deku...
Thank you, Brady, for calling in. Goodness, my brain short-circuited there for a hot second. Thank you for calling in. And yeah, I guess there are a few things we do need to unpack a little bit. You've heard us mention the Enneagram. You guys can find a link to the Enneagram website in the show notes, which, guys, where can they go to find the show notes?
Our website.
Yes, but if they want to use a short link...
They can literally Google it.
If they want to use a short link to get to the show notes in the newest episode, that can be found at Kyle...
bit.ly/minmaxpod.
I was just really hoping he'd say Google.
Oh, good grief. Hooligans. I podcast with hooligans.
But Brady, to clarify, since I think you were specifically asking us to define what the Enneagram is.
Sure.
If you've heard of the Myers-Briggs, sort of in like personality inventory, it's like that, just a little more thorough. So the Enneagram of personality basically breaks down your personality into 9 different types, 1 through 9, you know, and then each type has a specific sort of archetype to it. So you've heard Alan say multiple times that he's an 8. Alan, do you want to say what the archetype of the 8 is?
Gosh, you're putting me on the spot, and I'm trying to remember.
Well, you boast about it so much, I didn't think I'd be putting you on the spot.
Oh, good grief. I know what I am, but I sometimes don't always remember the exact breakdown of what it is.
I'll just tell you. So an 8 is a challenger.
Thank you.
And they typically like to buck authority a lot of the time and be in control and try to change the status quo. You've heard Kyle and I consistently talk about being 5s, but we're on opposite sides of our wings on a 5. A 5 is an investigator. We have a tendency to be stingy, but we're also really thorough in our research and thinking thoroughly about different things and consequences and whatnot. We really hate being helpless. Where Kyle is a wing 6, is there anything specific, Kyle, that you would associate with a 5 wing 6?
Oof, yeah. I'll have to remember a little bit here, too, because it's been a little while. But so 5 wing 6 is the problem solver. So, I'll kind of, I think if I'm remembering right from when I took it in seminary, a big part of it boils down to, because isn't 6 the loyal person?
Yeah, the loyalist.
Yeah, so it comes down a lot to... I seem to recall the description as being really stressed out and high strung, which is a general 5 trait, and so describes everything about my life half the time. Yeah, and then just kind of with that loyal piece thrown in there, in which I mean, I'm kind of a quintessential people pleaser, as much as I hate to admit it.
Which is why you're a Hufflepuff.
And there's the full circle.
Oh, goodness. Yep.
So now that we've just unpacked most of the contents of my personality, guys.
Right. But like in contrast with that, 5 wing 4s are called the visionaries. So like where you're, you know, we're both high strung, but we're high strung for different reasons. You're high strung because I think kind of geared towards that people pleasingness. Whereas like as soon as someone thinks I'm trying to people please them, I just go into myself and into my own head and I'm like, you think I'm trying to people please you? Come on now. And then I'll just stop talking to you and I'll ghost you entirely and go into my own head and be like, I'm here for my own pleasure, madam.
What's really cool about the Enneagram, too, is so the numbers that you've been hearing us say, like Ashley and Kyle are both fives with opposite wings. The wings are kind of secondary traits. But what it also does, too, is it also breaks down where you go in stress and where you go when you're feeling your most confident.
Yeah.
So in the eight goes to two in growth. Goodness, I need to learn how to speak today. Eight goes to two in growth and then goes to five in stress. So when I get all stressed out, I invade Kyle and Ashley's territory like a bull in a china shop because I all of a sudden like, you guys think you know what you're doing? I'm going to come in here and be a stressed out eight.
Right, which is complicated then because when fives are in stress, they go to seven. So we're just like, we throw all, basically we're that gif of that person throwing all the papers in there and flipping a table. And we're just like, let's just do all the fun things because who cares? I'm not going to be the responsible one anymore. But when we're healthy, we'll integrate into eight. So then we become you at your healthiest, which is annoying for you because you become us in our unhealthiest moments.
Right.
So we start to manage you as ourselves, or as you, being you as us.
Right. And then when I go into my most healthiest state, I go into two, which is the helper. And so I'm just trying to help things go along. And all of a sudden, you guys are coming in behind me trying to pick up the slack. I was like, no, I got it. I'm trying to do things well. So I'm trying to help.
At your best, you're an awkward, healthier version of me in general.
Yeah, it's all sorts of fun. But it's really interesting, too, because there's been a lot of documentation that's been written on the Enneagram. We'll link a couple of books in the show notes as well that really do a really good job of breaking down the Enneagram. And it's just a really helpful tool. Not something to base your entire life off of. You hear us make jokes about our types, but there's too many folks, especially in a lot of the millennial circles, that make so much of the Enneagram. They wear their identity on it so much that it gets careful that they have to remember this is a tool to understand yourself, not the book to build your life on. I think that's an important thing to note in our talking and really liking the Enneagram, but also acknowledging it also has problems when you start wearing this as your identity.
Right, yeah. And the reason that when I'm teaching and we get into group discussion, I suggest the Enneagram over the Myers-Briggs is because there's more room for growth there and it's relationship based. So if you think about, you know, Kyle and I are both fives, but we're different types of fives. And even if we were both five wing sixes, we'd still be different in that type of five wing six. So if you think of your type as like a color in general, and then there are different shades of that color.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of like a Crayola box of crayons, you know, there's blue. But there are so many different types and shades of blue. So we're going to be different shades of blue. So we're going to be our own variant on what that's going to look like. Why are you laughing?
Because of all of the things, the color that you go to is blue when you guys are both Enneagram 5. So what's funny is when you guys hit lows and things like that, the color that's associated with lows is always blue. So you basically just said, we're both different types of depressive colors.
Thanks. Wow.
I'm just kidding.
Rude.
It just made me laugh that was the color that you chose of all of the colors. It just...
How like just an eight to go, you're sad all the time. You know what I'm going to do? Make a joke of how sad you are.
Hey, aren't you guys both the people that always make the joke of sad is happy for deep people?
Well, it is. So back off. let us live
prepared.
Our bliss. Which is deep depression and sadness.
Which is all the different shades of blue.
It's better than 50 shades of gray.
Ugh. Nice. Nice slam dunk.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, goodness. But anyway, Brady, if you're looking for anything to help you kind of understand better how you relate to people and how you'd like to grow, Enneagram's a good place to start off. And then there are always, you know, different resources that they suggest outside of that. But you can... Most likely, whatever local library is near you, you'll be able to find the Enneagram textbook that has all the like questionnaires and things to help you find your type. You should be able to find that in your library. I strongly suggest you look it over. It gives you a lot of great resources, not only to understand your type, but maybe the types of other people that are in your life. And then you can have a better dialogue as to how your relationships work and, you know, how you can be better to one another.
Also, thank you for suggesting a anime character that we had not, none of us really watched Trigun at all, so
no.
We're going to have to look that up. We'll link Trigun in the show notes so people know where to find it. But speaking of all of this stuff about fives and being high-strung and always stressed
again,
out.
Again, with all of like, the negative qualities of our type, Kyle.
Right?
Yeah.
I want to spin to our topic.
You notice, wait. I'm going to point this out. You notice how he maintains control?
Oh, yeah.
Dang right I maintain control.
Oppressing us by drawing out those negative qualities? Uh-huh.
They're not trustworthy. You know why? Because they're sad sacks.
Can't let the sad sacks lead anything.
Don't rain on our rained out parade.
So, Kyle.
I genuinely have no idea where this is going.
Sad Kyle, do you want to introduce us to the topic idea that you were talking about?
Oh, that's where
about?
We're going right
Yeah,
now.
That's where I was talking about, because He's being just... high strung.
Yeah, well, so we've been... Wait a second.
It's so much fun when it comes home, when it all of a sudden the chickens come home to roost.
Fun for you, maybe. So anyway.
Chickens coming home to roost is just chicken noodle soup for the soul.
Ugh.
I know.
It's fine, guys. Let's just spend the rest of the episode
riffing on each other.
Random cliches about our personalities and insulting one another. I'm sure the listeners are just fascinated by this point.
I'm sure they probably are. They're probably picking sides. Hey, guys, let us know who wins.
Everything's a competition with you.
Yep. Yeah. Anyway, topics.
Okay, you're both looking at me. Do I have your rapt attention so we can actually get started now?
Yes, sir.
Yes, Kyle.
There's that high strung again. Okay, so... So we've been kind of talking off air about... some different novels and things, and we kind of thought it would be fun to look at and kind of chat about some of the trends and patterns we've seen in a lot of, especially like young adult fiction, like a lot of those kind of series that have gotten really big over the last few years. I think the obvious one that we've already gone to would be Harry Potter. I almost just said Hogwarts.
You know that Hogwarts series? Everybody's
you know, that
going gangbusters over.
School and the magic. Hunger Games might be another really good example that's gotten big in the last few years. I didn't really get into it, although I think I saw the first movie, but Maze Runner, different, you know, series of that kind of general category, kind of the young adult gets really big and then disappears after a while type of novel. So I think one of the places or kind of where we started off into this topic was a conversation about a series of unfortunate events.
Yep.
And series two or season two having just dropped not too long ago on Netflix. So Ashley, you want to kind of pick that up and give us your wonderful thoughts about that?
Sure. Series of Unfortunate Events was written by Daniel Handler, and he writes under the pseudonym Lemony Snicket, which right off the bat as a kid, I was like, someone with a code name? This is baller. and I had already read Harry Potter, at least what had been released up to that point. And then I think Series of Unfortunate Events came out in the 90s, like roughly around the same time, but someone had suggested Harry Potter to me first. I read, I think, up to the third book because it's what was around. And then I was like, well, I need something else to read. And we were at Shopko, which is like, it's like the Target of Northeastern Wisconsin. And whenever we'd go to Shopko to pick up whatever we needed for that month, my mom would do this really great thing where I would ask to go look at the books. She would kind of drop me off in the general media section she'd go and get all of her errands done and then just kind of loop back around and pick me up when she was done. So within that time of like 45 minutes or so, I could at least get half a book read. And the books that they started having in stock were the series of unfortunate events, which they didn't have at our library yet. So I would just sit on a shelf and just go through those things like crazy. And I think I got through at least half the series just through that process alone. And then my mom picked up on it. She's like, I think I'm going to start buying these for her. So like at book fairs and stuff, we'd get them. But what captivated me about them is about these three young orphans, the Baudelaire siblings. Violet's the oldest, and she likes to invent things. She really loves tinkering. Klaus, who is the bookish one, he likes to sit and read, so he knows a lot of facts about stuff. And then Sunny, who is the baby, and her total skill, and this is where it's just like goofy and fun and whimsical, her skill is that she likes to bite things. And she has very sharp teeth, and she's teething all the time, so she can like basically whittle with her teeth, and so she'll bite things into shapes to be helpful. And so together, they're picked up by this banker, and they're like, hey, we're really sorry, your parents died in a tragic fire, but it's okay, because someone's gonna, you know, take you in and be your guardian for the rest of your lives. And this guardian that they're taken to in the first book, The Bad Beginning, is the horrible Count Olaf, who is the villain throughout the entirety of the series. And you find out through a series of unfortunate events that he's wrapped up in this whole mysterious group called the VFD, which, you know, is the acronym for various associations, including the Volunteer Fire Department and all these other different things. And they're like the orphans are constantly trying to figure out and unpack what the VFD actually does. And they find out that there's like a good side to the VFD and a bad side of the VFD. And there was a split at one point, and these families are feuding. And so it was like all that kind of like spy sort of stuff. But these kids are like being inventive about how they're trying to get out of trouble all the time. And it always, like, Daniel Handler makes no bones about it. It will always end badly. Every book will end badly. And he makes it very clear, like, you will never be happy with the outcome. But I liked the fact that, as a kid, I just liked the fact that it was an adult basically being straight with me and being like, look, things are crap. They're going to continually be crap. I'm not going to, like, try to sugarcoat this at all. It's just going to be crap. I'm going to make it entertaining, and I'm going to teach you a lot of big words you didn't know in the process, but it's mostly going to be crap. And I was just captivated by that because I'm like, sweet, an adult trust me with the truth of the world.
And there's that gloom and doom attitude again.
Yep, basically. I was like, thank you, sir. You are doing me a service.
Do you realize what was probably on the backside of Lemony Snicket's coffee mug?
What? Also, Is there a back to a coffee mug? They're typically circular.
Well, sure. So
be left-handed for 5 minutes and you will realize, yes, there is.
Don't sound bitter or anything, Kyle.
I still don't understand. You could just, they're not.
Where I was going with that is on one of the sides of his coffee mug probably says humanity is a trash heap.
Probably. He probably agreed
with that.
He got
there before us, guys.
He did.
But I enjoyed the novel so much as a kid because it reflected back to me a lot of stuff that I was seeing on my own anyway. You know, living in a small town, you know a lot about a lot of people that you wouldn't typically want to anyway. And I
yes,
think, you know,
yes,
the
you
three
do.
Of us all grew up in small towns, so we get that idea.
Right.
And that's just common for small towns in general. When you live in a small town, you know a lot about a lot of people. You typically don't talk about it. And it's funny because our friend Ben, once he visited the Midwest, and he's just like, I feel like the common sort of like demeanor of the Midwest is that something terrible has happened, but no one will talk about it. And that's kind of what like living in a small town is like.
Yeah.
Lots of like terrible things have happened, but no one will talk about them. You know, unless they get too drunk at the local corn boil.
Yeah, right.
But it was, you know, it was that kind of morbid truth of like, things are bad. People will always there will be people that will get away with bad things. You can't really do too much about that except perpetually try to do good regardless. So I really appreciated that. It's very moralistic, honestly. So if you don't like moral tales, you're going to hate it because it is very moralistic. But as a kid, I needed to hear a moral tale that was honest about the fact that bad people sometimes get away with bad things. But that doesn't mean that that's a reason to stop doing good and to stop being inventive and to stop trying to, you know, push for the truth. So it was that. It was the sort of like secret society, spy sort of stuff and riddles, trying to solve a mystery. It was all of the things that I absolutely love about storytelling kind of in one thing. So I got wholly invested in that entirely. And even now as an adult, like I still am drawn to that constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Like we were watching the series on Netflix and it was giving me chills. And when we finished the second season, like I was tearing up, not because I'm like happy about how the characters end up at all, or because I like seeing people like upset.
Because how could you in that series?
Right, exactly. I don't know what it is about like the core essence of my being, but it just such good storytelling and the push for people trying to do the right thing regardless just made me so happy to see that sat there. I was like, well, I guess it's going to be a while before I can feel this kind of deep sense of joy again.
And then she turns and picks up another book and says, oh, let's try this one.
Right, exactly.
5 minutes later, oh, it's going to be so long until I feel this deep sense of joy again. I know how this goes.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, to be honest, though, like when it comes down to, you know, my, you know, young adult fiction, it's always that series I go back to. Sure. I do love Harry Potter. It's enjoyable, but I don't love it nearly as much as I love the series of Unfortunate Events.
Hmm.
So I think just to see it done well now again is just like a renewed sense of joy.
So since I haven't watched it, and just for context for me and for our listeners, how far does the second season take us in the series?
It takes us, so they've been taking each season in 3 to 4 book chunks, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. So season one goes through the first 3 books. So The Bad Beginning, The Reptile Room, and The Wide Window. Mm-hmm. So you go through 3 guardians. And then season 2 goes through their time at Prufrock Preparatory, which I can't remember what the Austere Academy.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is like 5, maybe? Or is that 4?
No.
I honestly don't know. I haven't
4.
Read any of these. I never read these growing up.
5 is... Shoot. Because then there's the Carnivorous Carnival. No, after Prufrock, they go to the Horrible Hospital, which I think is 5. And then it's the Carnivorous Carnival, which is 6.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Because they escape the carnival, and that's when things like... I remember closing the book on the Carnivorous Carnival and going like, what do you mean there's more? How can you continue from that? And that's what's always kind of engaging about that about the story is you're just like, how could there possibly be anything worse than what just happened? Mm. And how could you have any sense of hope left after that? But what's really interesting is the kids actually start to wrestle with that specifically, and they get self-conscious about their decisions because in order to survive, they start questioning what they should do, and they start doing things like lying in small ways to good people to try to get something done to be able to move forward. And then they get really upset with themselves for having done so, even though it got the desired effect. They start worrying about becoming the people that they're trying to fight against. And so then you see that moral conflict, and they start thinking about, okay, what's the actual end goal here? Do we want to even, what's the point in winning if we're just going to become the people that we're fighting against altogether? Would it be better just to lose, but to lose as the moral people we've been trying to defend the whole time? And I valued that so much because it felt like it was an honest representation of what people deal with every day.
Right.
I missed one. They do actually cover the Airstats elevator.
Oh, okay.
So
I forgot about that one. So it's Prufrock Preparatory. They go to the Austere Academy, Airstats elevator, then the hospital, and then the carnival.
Right. But we started talking about this series with some friends of ours, and a little bit of controversy came up surrounding it, because they were looking at the series, and they know we were going to talk about this. Like, this is one of those things this was something we all deeply engaged on. So of course we're going to end up talking about it. But they made the comment that they couldn't get through the books because they felt like the world was dark enough. And feel free to chime in on this. You know who you are if you feel like we're misrepresenting your argument here. We'd love to have you chime in on this if you feel like we don't do a good job there. But he felt the world was dark enough without having a book series that had no hope be marketed towards children. And I think all of us kind of reacted in a way. It was like, I don't know that that's what it is. And so, Ashley, that's where your argument started to come in with, every time these children are faced with a moral quandary, they try to rise to the occasion. And even though things keep getting darker, they are perpetually themselves the hope. And they are working very hard and relying on each other and learning to rely on each other, even in the midst of making mistakes like lying to good people. So trying to do a bad thing for the right reasons and not liking the results that happen, even though and they were learning through all of these things.
Yeah, well, and what's so astounding to me about the series is it's basically satire for young children. So, like, jokes that are made, and I'll try to come up with one off the top of my head, but I do know that there's a point where, like, so in the Carnivorous Carnival, you know, they disguise themselves as carnival freaks to try to, like, infiltrate and get some information and get out of there safely, but with the right people. And so they end up having to stay with the freaks that work and live at this carnival. One of these freaks is a guy that's so, in all intents and purposes, completely normal and actually fairly attractive looking. His freakish quality is that he's ambidextrous. And he is so he's so plagued by this identity that he keeps trying to identify with the rest of the freaks. And he's convinced that he is just freakish and horrible. And so he has this, like, false sense of this false sense of plight that doesn't actually plague him in any way. He's, like, a totally normal person, but he's taken on this identity because it's benefited him.
Sure.
And he can, like, get on, but he's bought this hook, line, and sinker, so he does act so put upon that he is ambidextrous and no one could possibly love him. And then it turns him into a horrible person. And when they have to perform for the crowd, like, they do say horrible things, but, like, they're so bizarre in the way they react to the performers. And then because they've been so put upon and cast down and cast out, that then when Count Olaf, spoiler alert, offers them a place in his troop, they're like, oh, you want us? You see us? You actually see that we're worthwhile in some way, even though you're treating us poorly? You still believe that we could be useful? Yeah, of course we'll join you. So then they end up attacking the very people that had been kind to them in the first place the whole time, the Baudelaires.
Yeah, which, I remember, like, that.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since I've read it, but yeah, as you're describing it, it's all starting to come back a little bit. Yeah, that was an interesting, that was a heavy book.
Yeah, but it's, like, as a kid, especially if you're a kid who feels like you don't fit in or don't belong, how tempting is that to become the bully?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I work with children every day. I see it literally every day. I have a handful of kids that I have to have this conversation with every single day now, because it's like kids don't have the capacity to deal with it, right? I think I've said this before because it's one of my favorite lines from all of Firefly, although I think the line is actually from Serenity, about, you know, when they're talking about the Reavers in the series, and I think it's Mal who makes the comment, like, when you see that kind of evil, the only thing you can do to deal with it is to become it. And that's how the Reavers would spread in the series, is like people would, you know, the Reavers would attack and leave like two victims behind. And then those people just couldn't deal with the trauma of what they saw. So they became that evil. And I think that's so true to human psyche, is like, if we can't, you know, we become that thing that we can't otherwise find space for in our heads, in our universes.
Right. Exactly. Well, and then, like, even, like, the concept of what truth is kind of, like, very, very, very elegantly put in the series without becoming preachy or over politicized in any way, which is kind of excellent. So like there's a point where the kids are at a couple books back at the Academy Proofrock, and they're told like, no, you'll definitely be safe here. You know why? Because we have a very enhanced computer system that will identify if someone is Count Olaf or not. And of course what happens is Count Olaf has a disguise that keeps him from being recognized by this computer, but they keep pushing, no, we have technology that will protect you and it'll be fine. And I'm like, this is really uncomfortable.
I feel
triggered right now, but it's fair, it's true, it's a completely, you know, fair critique. And that's what I appreciate about it, is that they critique and satirize and comment upon without being preachy or political, in the sense that you're like, oh, okay, I see your agenda here. They're punching up.
Yeah, like punching up at futurism, like with that idea of technology is going to do all these great things and protect us and feed us. And
right. Well, and the whole process of like not trusting children when they say, no, I feel unsafe or I feel like I'm in danger in some way. No. Let the adults handle this. Do the adults ever handle it?
No.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to pick this up. I'm going to go in a slightly different direction, and I'm going to start by saying, even though I think I got through the first 10 series of Unfortunate Events books, and I know that only because I still have those 10 on my bookshelf, and I distinctly remember I never finished the last 3. And it was interesting because I actually went back to pick them up again not too long ago, because I was like, oh, well, this is, you know, another one of those book series that I like started once upon a time, just like Harry Potter. I should go back and finally finish it. And I remembered the reason that I stopped reading it is because I think for me, it just started to feel a little almost gratuitous in the end. And this is me maybe projecting, and it might also be that I just don't enjoy satire as much as you do, Ashley.
Yeah, it's kind of my lifeblood.
Yeah. But I think when I went back and started rereading, I read The Bad Beginning, which made me very uncomfortable for completely different reasons than it did when I was a kid. Oof. But then I got into Reptile Room and I just started to remember, I was like, it just kind of almost feels to me like, and I have no grounding for this, I have no, you know, reason to actually believe this is true, but there, for some reason, as I'm reading it, it just kind of almost felt like, oh, David Handler has some stuff in his past that he can't deal with, and now he's just like foisting it off into this novel. Like it just felt gunk.
That's so interesting, because I've heard interviews with Daniel Handler and like people who have like helped at his tables when he's done readings and stuff, that he is like the nicest person ever, like the best author they've ever worked with. I'm like, that's good to hear, because you hear of a lot of really terrible behavior from authors and stuff. So I'm like, doing me a solid once again, Daniel Handler.
Right. So, you know, just a difference of opinion there, ultimately. But yeah, I think regardless of my opinion of the series as a whole, which isn't low, it just isn't quite my thing. I wholeheartedly agree that it's critical and so valuable for us to be teaching those types of lessons to kids. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to do that, because it's hard to want to expose kids to trauma at a young age. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, and again, this is something that I'm seeing every day now, and it's mortifying to me. This is something that the kids are facing every day. And if we're hiding in a closet saying like, oh no, bad things aren't out there. Well, you didn't have a 5-year-old ask you the other day about what they should do if a person walks into the building with a gun and points it at them. Mm-hmm. Right? Like,
yeah.
That's the reality that children today are dealing with. Like those are the stories they're hearing. Like school shootings are becoming such a common reality that it's like, I can't even start going there, because I'm already going to start tearing up.
No, like, I hear you. Because I've had students that have come to my classroom and they're like, and these are international students, and they go, yeah, my parents were really afraid to let me study abroad. And I was like, oh, just in general? Like, no, in the U.S. specifically. And I was like, oh, why? Mm-hmm. And they're like, because of all of your shootings. And I'm like, yeah, that's a fair point.
Yeah.
But then they would ask me the same question. So like, what is your procedure if this happens? I'm like,
right.
Okay, well, let's break this down. Because I have one, luckily. But it's horrible.
Yeah. But on a slightly lighter note, I think the value in that is that we have to have those discussions about the darkness in the world. And I think that's an interesting trend we started seeing for quite a while there in young adult literature, especially with that explosion we had of dystopian novels.
Mm, okay.
You know, like, yeah. Hunger Games hit, and I'm pretty sure Maze Runner, well, I know Maze Runner is kind of in that category.
Yeah,
and,
you're right.
The Giver movie came in, you know, like, yeah. Just everything dystopian started just taking off all of a sudden.
Fahrenheit 451 just got produced by...
Yep.
Well, this was, like, after the tail end of a bunch of zombie movies being produced, right? Yep.
This is true, too, yeah.
Apocalyptic literature.
You had Apocalypse
really...
straight into dystopia. It's kind of what we saw culturally for a while, right?
Yeah. So what is that?
I think, you know, okay, far be it from me to assume that I understand the currents of the universe, but I actually just read, not too long ago, The Wounded Healer by Henry Nouwen, which, have you guys read that one?
No, I haven't.
No, though Nouwen's legit.
Oh, see, and so I'll offer this little bit, and I'm not going to go too deep into it because it's fairly personal, but, you know, it's something that I've been really wrestling with, or, you know, just faith in general, something that I've been really wrestling with over the last few months. You know, I had some things happen over the last year, and it's been a struggle. And I you know, I've kind of shied away from it. I found after I moved, you know, I kind of got into the idea of church hunting and then shied away from the idea of church hunting. And it was just kind of like, well, I'll just have my Sunday mornings to myself for a while kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finally got to a point, here just a few weeks ago where I was like, no, I need to kind of re-engage with my faith a little bit. I need to revisit this and decide, you know, what it is that I feel and kind of re-enter that world a little bit. So I picked up that book, and at first I was really just like, oh, I swear I cannot deal with another like fruity, devotional, happy peppy book.
And that's what I expected talking about.
Yeah. Who does, right? But I open it up and immediately it's like this. It's a very sociological, like, thoughtful analysis of contemporary society.
Hmm.
Like, it was not what I was expecting at all, but it was exactly what I needed. So, you know, take that as you will. But he kind of breaks down this whole idea of, like, in a sense, I don't think he uses this word specifically, but we're living in a world of disillusionment where people are struggling so much. And ministers, you know, he talks specifically to ministers trying to minister within this, you know, kind of generational context, that we struggle so much with the breakdown of the society that we've had, you know, all of the kind of traditions, the way of life that we've carried on for so long, are changing in so many different ways. And I think, we're so much more of a global society, which is causing us to be exposed to so many different ideas now,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, it kind of factionalizes us in a strange way, because it's like, okay, so, you know, even the three of us in this room, right? Like, we all came from slightly different contexts. We are all, you know, small town America, but at the same time, you know, we all have friends from, like, you guys have friends in the UK, and I, you know, my family hosted a foreign exchange student from Germany, and, you know, things like that, where those new ideas and those different contexts are becoming so readily available to us,
mm-hmm.
that it's easy to see how we could develop societally in such a way that it's like, oh, that's a good idea for me, and you're over here saying, oh, that's a good idea for me, and then we try to come back together, right? And we're not even the same social context anymore, even though we might live in the same area.
Mm-hmm.
So this is me, like, spinning sociological theories at this point.
No, this is great. I'm here for it.
But I think the point that Nouwen makes in this book is, you know, we have to redefine the way that we see that context and really kind of hone in on some of the key factors that are impacting our generation. I know I'm going to forget now what all of his major factors are, but one of the things was, I think one of the things was kind of the disillusionment piece. The other thing was the fatherless generation idea. And he doesn't just mean that in terms of like a generation without dads, although that, you know, factors in very heavily as well. But I think it's to some extent kind of pulling on kind of a lack of leadership, in a sense, a lack of, you know, kind of proper role modeling and that kind of thing as well. Mm-hmm. So kind of more of a broad father figure type definition. But he digs into these things. And I think, you know, the only reason I bring all of this up is I think it just points us towards this need that we're seeing culturally to find something better, something different, right? Like we all kind of know something's not working, and that's why we have this phase of, well, apocalypse, because for some reason the end of the world sounds better than what we have now, right? Or dystopia, where, oh, maybe getting this revealing glimpse into a really, really awful, you know, situation that seems good helps us to understand our context in a different way.
Oh, yeah. I think what you're getting at is why a lot of people like the idea of the sort of like watchmaker god who can like set the earth for a certain period of time, and then eventually it'll just run out or mm-hmm. blow up so that we can start all over again. Because I think people right. find solace in the idea that we can just try to start over to get it right the next time. Like that whole right. idea of second chances, just one more time. Okay, do over. Okay, just one more do-over, because then we, you know, we've screwed it up this far, so what does it matter if what we do now? Because we'll always get a do-over. I think that's always, like, really appealing to people.
Sure. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And yet, the other somewhat ironic thing within that is usually one of the thematic points of a lot of that genre is, oh, guess what? It didn't get any better.
Mm-hmm. Right,
people
exactly.
are still people. What do you know?
Yeah, we're doomed to repeat the same mistakes that we've always done. And it's nothing that is happening now is nothing that didn't happen 100 years ago. There just might be new pieces in play.
Right. Well, I think the authors get that. I think that they're just capitalizing on that desire for a do-over. And then they're like, cool, cool, cool. So here's this thing you want. You want to know how it ends?
Yeah.
It ends right. the same damn way.
Right.
Isn't that funny? That's hilarious.
What do you know?
Yeah, I think something, too, that kind of comes to mind, too, and this this will relate a little bit more loosely, but I think it kind of pulls in the same mindset, too, is a lot of this kind of, in my head, comes down to a lot of the times we all kind of live in this idea of second chances, but also we live with an ejector seat mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And we see a lot of the times in a lot of pop culture stuff, a lot of relational stuff, people aren't willing to commit, and they aren't willing to really kind of get locked down to something, locked down into a place, a job, a relationship, mm-hmm. or things like that. And they always have like one hand in the ejector seat. So it's if Ashley does something that it is the last straw, I'm out. And mm-hmm. people are so quick to pull out or ghost people as you.
I mean, to be fair to your counsel, I am a horrendous person.
I can't even. But do you guys get what I mean? What I'm kind of getting at, though, like,
oh, yeah,
it seems
absolutely.
It's like everyone is lit. Like, all right, I'm gonna go here for just a second, and I'm not picking on particular parties, but I'm gonna go here for a second. in such a politicized state that the United States is living in right now, everyone is living 4 years to 4 years. Everyone is living every presidential cycle. Whether you agree with the president that is currently in power, or whether you liked Obama, or whether you liked President Bush. Everyone is living 4 years to 4 years because they're saying the other party will do it better. We just have to suffer through what's happening right now and things will get better, and it won't.
Right. So they're not investing in what the resources are currently available. They're just like, well, let's just like hold on for now and keep our loyalties where they are. And then hopefully we'll win the next one. And that's when we can do the real work. When really you're just stalling for any hard work whatsoever.
Right.
Yeah, no, I get that. Well, and I think that's why I got frustrated at the end of Hunger Games, because it felt like, yes, apocalypse. Yes, we're building onto something. Here we go. Here we go. Oh, never mind. Everything's blown up again. Never mind. No happy ending for you. And that's part of why I liked Series of Unfortunate Events,
uh-huh.
because it didn't make any bones about the fact that it was going to end poorly every time, but it commit sure. to that. And so I found the hope in that it committed to the fact that here are some moral principles that are important regardless yep. of whether we're rewarded for following through on them or not. They're important to hold on to. Whereas with some of the other apocalyptic novels that I still enjoyed regardless,
oh, yeah.
I was just like, some of these moral principles you're kind of just like letting go of because they're inconvenient to hold while you are fighting to your death. It's no big deal.
Right.
It's whatever.
I'll also say this on Hunger Games too, that I really liked Hunger Games. It felt like right at the end, she just got bored. Because I swear, I read all three books inside of 36 hours of each other because I stayed home sick. And when I'm sick, I binge read. That's usually when I sit down and read. So I read the first two books in 12 hours and had read the next one the next day. And I hit the page where the bomb goes off, literally and figuratively. And all of a sudden, read on. I was like, wait, what? And I reread it three times because the whole thing changes inside of 200 words.
Right. I do think it was sloppy writing.
Yeah, I agree. To me, it felt like she got under the crunch of, oh, hey, we gotta get this out. Mm-hmm. You know, or it almost felt rushed. Mm-hmm. Like she didn't quite know where she was going with it. And then all of a sudden she had to get this third book out. I don't know. Regardless, we all seem to agree wasn't a thing.
Yeah. But I think it's funny how, you know, we're discussing these book series as adults. And what's interesting to me is this, as we've been discussing, this sort of like hype with young adult and children's literature among adults. Whereas kids are just like, I'll just read whatever and I'm cool with bouncing from thing to thing. And they have the flexibility and the fluidity to be able to kind of read whatever kind of captures their imagination, and they'll be obsessed with it for a little bit, and then they'll move on to a thing with little to no trauma. But take, you know, 30 seconds on Twitter, type in Harry Potter or, you know, Hunger Games, whatever, and you'll find mass amounts of outrage from 30-year-olds who are so upset still that Katniss did not choose Gale. So it's I think that's interesting that something is meant to be for children, and rightfully so. They deserve, you know, good literature as well, being co-opted by adults for our own entertainment. And Derek White, the Geek Preacher, he posted this really pretty amusing to me, even though I do enjoy Harry Potter, this comedic video about a guy who's comparing Harry Potter to Star Wars and how they're basically the same narrative. And the guy brings up some pretty good points, honestly. Like, I watch it, I was like, yeah, okay. And I watch it thinking, like, total skepticism. But it's legitimate, and it made me laugh. And so I do find it interesting, the people who are really fixated on certain young adult literature and how they use it to actually morph their identity or mold their identity to, and then they can't move on from that specific narrative.
Right,
and it becomes the reason for them doing anything. You know, there's even like a Hogwarts running club, which, cool, whatever you can do to get people active and healthy, and I think that's awesome. Nerds are doing really cool things. But remove that narrative from you know, their life in some way, and suddenly they're left with nothing. Which it concerns me, even though I don't know if people know this, but I too am a nerd and I do fixate on things. You know, I do have to consistently ask myself, just as a health check, hashtag medicine check, you know, what would happen if this didn't exist? Would I still be able to go on? Well, I think I would be able to. I think I'd be okay. But I do know people who would not be okay if this stopped being a thing. And I think that's why they get so hung up on when the narrative doesn't go the way that they think it should be written as. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but I do think that there's an issue there when something that's written for children does not go the route that adults want it to go.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. And I think it harkens back to that very same idea of identity that you started talking about with the circus folk in Series of Unfortunate Events, right? Like, they need that sense of community, so whatever they can find that in, and this is something we've talked about before, you know, we latch on to that, and so that sense of community that we find in, you know, being a fan of Harry Potter or being a specific Harry Potter house, whatever it might be, you know, becomes our source of identity. And there's a problem with, there's a difference, I think, between identifying with something and finding the source of our identity in something. You know, to identify with something is to say, oh, you know, Harry and I have some similar qualities. You know, we both wear glasses. We both have kind of shaggy hair, whatever. Those
you
are
both
the only
have scars on your forehead.
Have.
You get frequent headaches.
Totally.
You defeated a Dark Lord.
I was going for things that I have in common with Harry Potter, but that's fine. I have no lightning-shaped scar on my forehead. Sorry to disappoint, friends. But like, so, you know, so that's kind of the idea, identifying with, or, you know, more specifically, we could look at the Baudelaire reference and say like, oh, I value how they responded to this trauma, this crisis in their lives. Mm-hmm. I want to endeavor to, you know, kind of show that same strength when I struggle in my life, mm-hmm. right? That's identifying with a character. Finding your identity rooted in something like that is much more problematic, because then you are defined by that thing, mm-hmm. right? It's, you know, in the first case, I am something independent of the story and I'm engaging with the story. In the second case, it's, no, I am the story, you know, to put it at its most extreme.
Yeah. So I just, this sparked something in me that has always driven me nuts, but you've specified it. So that whole identify with and what was it? How was the dichotomy you created again?
I'm almost going to have to go back and listen just to hear my own thoughts again. Identifying with or finding my identity.
Yes, thank you.
In.
Okay, yeah. So the whole reason why I get frustrated with like Hunger Games and how Twilight is written, because that was a huge, huge big deal for a while as well, is because of how the protagonist is written as so vague in description. And the reason that this sparked is because, you know, you brought up the series of unfortunate events. I didn't get wrapped up in it as far as it becoming my identity, because Violet, Klaus, and Sunny have very distinct characteristics. They are described very vividly. I don't look like any of them. I don't have any of their personality characteristics. Like, I'm not an inventor like Violet. Mm-hmm. I don't tinker with things and build really cool inventions. I might be bookish like Klaus a little bit, but I certainly don't memorize statistics like he does. And I don't just bite crap. So I'm not like, you know, so, and there are like very, very specific, well-written characteristics for all of these characters where you can visualize them. You can see, you know, maybe some similarities here and there, but ultimately they're their own unique, distinct characters.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at Katniss and you look at Bella from Twilight, they are vague, the vague every woman, every like teenage girl, you know, mousy brown hair, kind of awkward, klutzy, doesn't really like fit in. Every teenage girl, like 13, 14-year-old girl ever that feels awkward and clumsy in their own body and doesn't know what to do with their life and is uncertain with the kind of power that they could grow into having. Right? So anyone can read that narrative and go, oh, that's me. Oh, I can become this. I can achieve it. I can, you know, get the every guy, whatever. And so then you start seeking your identity out in that narrative. And of course, then you want it to play out well because it's you in the story. So you want to end in romance and you want to end with the happy ending and you want to, you know, go on the adventure and do all these things, which is
and you would have chose Gale, darn it. So naturally Katniss should have. So now I'm outraged.
Right, exactly. So it's those sorts of things that we see in like Pulp Fiction as well with like Conan the Barbarian or like some of the other characters that, you know, those idyllic tropes that guys run to as well. Like women have them too.
Mm-hmm.
We just tend to talk about the guys ones more because it's easier to pick on because they seem so outlandish. But like Twilight and Hunger Games is the same dang thing.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And it's that lack of descriptive, distinctive characteristic in those characters that gets into that sticky, unhealthy trap of this is my identity rather than just identifying with a narrative that drives me insane.
Oh, yeah. I think it drives you insane, rightly so. So this kind of wraps up. I think this is a really good place for us to stop. We're going to kind of do a mini series here on young adult literature and movies and a few other things. We're going to delve into an area that we really haven't talked about too much. But if you guys have thoughts on things, minmaxpod@gmail.com, minmaxpod everywhere else. You can find us on Twitter at minmax, or on Reddit, rather, at minmaxpodcast, subreddit and user account. And if you guys want to call us and leave us a message, 973-789-9639.
Oh, so
he's
close.
He's lost the power. Kyle, you've taken the power. Look.
No. 9 out of 10.
9369. There we go. Have it in my notes. I just didn't look down. I was trying to do it from memory. But yeah.
Oh,
we
how
would love...
the mighty have fallen.
Uh-huh. Yes.
I will be here. Wielding my scepter with dignity and strength.